hope the rest of you don't want to say that. Am I on? Yeah. Hope you've had a great week. We had a lot going on up here. You know, there was a group from my former church here this week, about 50 kids, and they had a great time. It only took them like 36 hours to get home. They got caught in that blizzard that went across the country and had to spend the night in Albuquerque. Praise Jesus. But they made it back, and they did a lot of things this week. They worked with Jessica Oaks on a sports, what'd you call it? She's jabbering and not even listening to me. Sportstacular? Is that what you called it? Sportstacular. Thanks. Down at the park, and had a lot of kids come to that on Friday, and they distributed 1,000 cards at 1,000 homes for us to advertise Easter and the Easter egg hunt and the Good Friday service, and painted these buildings over here. So those look great. And so that was a lot of fun to have them. You all were great hosts. Thanks for doing that. I hope we can have other groups come in and reach out to people. There was also a group that went to Guadalupe and spent all week doing backyard Bible clubs kind of stuff at Guadalupe, and had about 60 kids every day there. So it's a huge group. Apparently that kind of thing doesn't happen there a lot. So I was encouraged by that. Thanks for being here today. As you know, we're on a series of messages that we've called The Church, We, Not Me. And we're talking about the idea of just how important is the local church in the plan of God for the world. What place does the church hold? And what should we think about the church? And what should our place be in the church? And we've used this definition the last several weeks to help us get our brain around what is the church. And it's this: the church is a collection of people called by and for Christ who pursue God's glory together by living missional lives. A lot of words there, but tried to make it simple in a way we could understand. What is the church? Basically, the local church is a group of saved people who have been called by Jesus into a relationship with Him, and now they live together with their highest aim to honor Him, to pursue Him, to know Him more. And they do that by living missional lives. And that really grows out of this verse in John 20 that Jesus says, "As the Father has sent me, even so I'm sending you." So the work that Jesus started on earth is to continue. And that work is continued not by just one person, but by a whole bunch of people. And those people are those that are saved. And He brings them together to form local churches that are all different from each other. And they should be different, because we're all in different communities, and we're seeking to do a little bit different things, but we're all after the same purpose. So now we're talking through what are the characteristics of churches that God really uses. If you've been involved in church before, you know that not all churches are equal. Some follow the Bible, some don't. Some have great points of emphasis. Some seem to do the same things over and over and over, regardless of the outcome. Some are places where there are great relationships and lifelong friendships, and other places seem to, at times, hurt more than help. No church is perfect, but what are the characteristics or priorities of churches that God really uses, churches that really make a difference? And that's what we're talking about now. Last week, we talked about Bible-believing, that a church that God's really going to bless and that really is going to be built on Him is going to be a church that follows this book and that follows the author of this book. And today we're going to go on to our second priority, or our second characteristic of a church that God uses, and that's gospel-centered. So let me pray, and then we'll get rolling together. God, we've got a lot of work to do today, and we're going to look at a fun passage. I pray that You would teach us today, that You'd open our eyes to something that might seem common to a lot of us and help us to see something new. And Lord, with all of its flaws and with all of its failures, the church is a great thing. Because you tell us in the Word, which we explored last week, is to be the very foundation of everything that we are and do. You tell us that because Christ is now in heaven, that your work continues through your body, which is the church. So the church is a precious thing. You died for it. And now we are to carry on what you began through relying on you, coming together with our imperfections and all, but seeking with everything that we are to honor you, to point to you, to glorify you, to make a difference in Tempe, at ASU, and in the community, throughout the valley, and even to remote parts of the world. God, that you'd use Church on Mill to make a difference. And as we look at this idea today of a church being gospel-centered, being built on the truth that Jesus came from heaven, died on the cross, and rose again, and that it's through Jesus that we have life, as we look at what it means for a church to be built on that, help us to grow and to learn. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. If you would, look at Matthew chapter 18 with me. Matthew 18. If you brought a Bible. If not, we'll have the scripture here on the projector. Matthew 18, and I'll start in verse 23. Now, we just spent 7 weeks on this topic of being gospel-centered people. And today I want to emphasize and focus on what it means, not so much for us individually, but corporately, collectively. And explore that in a different kind of passage than we've looked at before. So let's look in verse 23 together. This is Jesus talking, and he's telling a parable. He says this, starting in verse 23. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, "Have patience with me, and I'll repay you everything." Let's stop there. So there's a man who owes a whole lot of money, and he's summoned by the king to come up the steps. I don't know if you've ever had to go up the steps, but I have. Even at traffic court, you have to go up the steps to meet with the magistrate, if you will. Okay? So this guy is told, come and meet with the king, and you got to come up the steps. Now, I'd imagine he knew what was coming, don't you? I mean, if he owed this much money to the king and he hadn't paid him back, he probably knew this was not going to be a good day. And he owed what is called 10,000 talents. Now, that doesn't mean like dancing and singing, okay? A talent was a measurement of weight that was used to calculate money. So you probably are not familiar with what 10,000 talents would mean. So let me see if I can clarify it for you. It was 6,000 denarii. All right? Does that help? Okay, that doesn't help. Think of it like this with me, okay? A denarii is one day of work. A denarii was a typical average man's wage of work for the day. And he owed 6,000 of those. So he was in some significant debt. So imagine if the king had said to him, you have to work for me every day until that debt is paid off. And 100% of what you earn goes to me. It would take him 164,000 years of work if you add all those up. All right? Now, some of you are looking at me like I'm absolutely nuts. And I'll explain that in a little while, why that comes out to that amount. Basically, it's an incalculable amount of money when you start figuring it up. Let's put it in our terms, if you will, okay? The average American owes $8,300 worth of credit card debt, all right? Some of us here more, some of us less. But the average American owes $8,300 in credit card debt. Now, we can get our brains around that, right? I mean, imagine somebody said to you, you have to pay that back today. Now, that would be hard, but maybe we could make enough phone calls to enough people that we could pull that off. Maybe. But let's think of America's debt load, all right? Throw it up there on the screen, if you would. Keep going. I think I gave it to you, didn't I? Do you have some numbers? Way at the end, he's saying. See if you can find it. It won't make any sense to you. Don't scroll through my whole sermon. You're blowing all the good stuff. I don't want to send them home on Cliff Notes. All right. Did you find it? Okay. Here is America's debt load, okay? $12,640,532,785,861.02. All right. Now, imagine somebody said to you, this is your personal debt. You owe me today, or I'm going to sell you and your family and all that you have, and I'm going to lock you up until you can pay it back. Now, that gives you some kind of feeling for the effect that this situation had. That's impossible. I mean, we can't even think in those kind of terms, let alone come up with a way to make that kind of money back. I'm making no political statement here. I'm just pointing out this is a lot of money. Okay? So, that's your debt. You've got to pay it back. Now, the king says what to him? What'd the king say? You got to pay it back. I'm going to do this, this, and this. So the man gets down on his knees and he begs. He says, please have patience with me. Just give me more time. I'd imagine it wouldn't be good to go home to your wife and say, guess what, honey? The boat, the house, the motorcycle, all that stuff I bought, I got to sell you because of it. That probably wouldn't go over too well. So he's begging. He's begging the king to give him more time. Now, mind you, that's the kind of debt we're talking about. What do you think the king would say? Away with you. No more. I mean, to accumulate this kind of debt must have taken a while, right? I mean, he didn't do it in a day. So he must have had a great amount of time to pay it back. But check out what the king does say. It's not at all what we would expect. Look at verse 27. Amazingly, the king listens, and he replies this way. And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. Now, this is mind-boggling. Not only does he say, okay, you can have more time, but he wipes it out. He takes it away completely. He lets him go scot-free. No more debt. Now, in reality, somebody has to take on that debt, right? So the king has said, I'll take it. I forgive you. You can go free. Free and clear. Now, there's no way Bank of America or Chase would ever do that for you. There's no way. And part of the mess that we're in financially now is because people have taken on so much debt that they couldn't pay it back. That's not all of the reason, but it's a part of it. So we have some kind of sense of what this means. Now, this makes for a great story, doesn't it? The king calls the man to come up the steps. He says, you owe me. Boom, 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 boom. The man says, I can't do it. Give me more time. And instead of saying, off with your head, the king says, I'm feeling good today. You're free. It's a Hollywood ending. I mean, we love stories like this. We pay money to go see movies like this. Right? This is the way it's supposed to end. But it's not the way it ends. Check out the rest of the story. But when the same servant went out, Now, how do you think he went out? Skipping? Whistling? Leaping? Jumping? Praising God? Right? He was probably pretty happy. I'd imagine he leaped down all of those steps. And he ran through town waving his arms. Everybody thought he'd gone nuts. This is a happy guy. All right? Now, when that same servant went out, verse 28, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. He owed 6,000. This guy owns 100. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, "Pay back what you owe." So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with me, "Have patience with me, and I will repay you." Now, does that seem odd to you? A couple things. If you notice that very closely, he found one of his servants. So we get the sense that he went looking for the guy. Okay? So apparently, he comes down the steps, and the first thing he does is he goes looking for the guy that owes him a measly 100 denarii. He goes and he says he wants the money back. He doesn't get it. So he begins choking the guy. I don't know if anybody owes you money, but I would recommend you don't go choking them. All right? Now, the guy says the exact same thing to him. Same words. This time it's just a pier. There were no steps to go up. They're standing on the same playing field. And yet, he in his mind has climbed up steps higher than the king. He has no authority over this guy. And yet he's treating him like garbage. Now let's see what happens. Before I get there, what kind of emotion does that conjure up in you? Picture that you had been in the courtroom of the king and you had seen what the king had done. That probably would have been shocking, right? So now you go out following the guy just because you're curious. What's he going to do? I mean, surely he's going to run around and tell everybody how wonderful the king is. But the first thing he does, come here. You're going to have to learn to quit sitting here, all right? He goes to Aaron, says, "Give me my 100 denarii." Okay? What? How does this make you feel?
I want to get away.
I wasn't talking to you. How does this make you feel? What kind of emotion does that conjure up? Anger. Exactly. Is anger a strong enough word? Disgust. I picture rage. I mean, you have got to be kidding me. This guy was just forgiven 6,000 denarii. And I'm going after the guy that owes 100. And he's saying to me the exact same thing. Please give me more time. That would definitely make me angry. Very, very, very angry. Now look at verse 29. So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me and I will repay you." Verse 30. He refused. And he went and he put him in prison until he should repay the debt. When his fellow servant saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed. To put it mildly, they were greatly distressed. So apparently that's exactly what happened. Someone that had seen what the king had done, followed the guy, saw what took place, and went back and told the king. They were greatly distressed by this. It's infuriating. Don't let this just be a stale story on the page. Picture that this actually took place. It's absolutely absurd that somebody forgiven so much wouldn't be willing to forgive so little. Now, I think what angers us from this story is not so much the guy's actions. I mean, is it wrong to try and collect on a debt? No. Our entire system of banking is based on the notion of lending and paying it back. That's the way it works. There's nothing wrong with that. So inherently, there's nothing bad about this. What's bad, what's poor, is what angers us is the incongruity between what the man had been given and what he was willing to give. Or to say that another way, between the mercy that was extended to him and the total lack of mercy he was willing to extend to his fellow person. That's what makes us mad. It's his action in light of what had been given to him. It's not that he was trying to get back on the debt. So look at 32. Let's see how it ends. In Jesus' story, the king feels the same anger that we feel. Then his master summoned him and said, "You wicked, wicked servant. I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had had mercy on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should repay all the debt. "So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother for your heart." So, the king reneges and puts the man in prison and says, "You have to stay there until you can repay this debt." Now, obviously that will never happen. He's not going to come up with $12 trillion. So he's going to spend forever there. Why? Because he didn't extend what had been given to him. Now, that's a sad story, isn't it? That's not the kind we like to go to Hollywood and see. That's not the kind we pay $12.50 for. We don't like that kind of story. It didn't have to end that way, did it? The guy could have merely said, "I forgive you the debt," or "I give you more time." And then we would have had this sweet Hollywood ending. But that's not how this one rolled. Now, we're in a series about the church. Today we're talking about the gospel. What in the world does two guys who owe money and a king have to do with the gospel? What does that have to do with anything? Did I pick the wrong passage? It seems that way, doesn't it? I mean, if we just look at it at face value, like what is he talking about? I would say it has everything to do with a church being built on the gospel. And let me see if I can explain what I mean. Jesus told stories, lots of them, to sort of bring truth home in a way that would smack you in the face before you even realized, "Hey, I'm talking to you." And this is one of those stories. So let me back up a little bit and give you some backstory, okay? King Louis XII of France once said this: "Nothing smells so sweet as the dead body of your enemy." All right? Nothing smells so sweet as the dead body of your enemy. Now, none of us would say that, right? But the sentiment we have felt. Forgiveness is difficult. Forgiveness is hard. Sometimes we don't even want it. We want blood. We want to hurt the person that hurt us. At worst. At best, we just want to merely shove them away and ignore them altogether. Forgiveness is hard. Jesus told many stories about forgiveness, and this is one of them. Look at verse 21. Peter came up to him, this is Jesus, and said, "Lord, how often will my brother sins against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times?" So he's saying, "Jesus, if a brother of mine sins against me if he hurts me, if he does something he shouldn't, how many times should I forgive him? Have you ever asked that kind of question? It's hard to get over being hurt. But it's much harder when it happens repeatedly. So how many times do we have to forgive? I mean, especially when the person does the same thing over and over and over. How many times do we forgive? Peter says up to 7 times. And he probably believed he was being exceptionally generous. Now look at Jesus' response in verse 22. Jesus said to him, I don't say to you 7 times, but 70 times 7. Now, you didn't know you were getting a math lesson today, did you? What in the world does that mean? That's just a Hebraic expression for saying an infinite amount of time. There is no limit. That's what Jesus meant. He meant forgiveness is to be extended endlessly. It has no limit. Now, if Jesus had said that to you, and you were Peter, you probably would have just fallen over. I mean, this would have been shocking to them. So, in this story, we have 2 servants, okay? And they're compared. And what this teaches us is the truth that genuine grace comes with an enormous responsibility. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. In a sense, you and I are like the first man in the story. We owe the king a great debt. Now, it's not money. The debt we owe the king is not money. You see, God is the creator or ruler or king, however you want to say it, of the universe. He made it. He created it. It's his. He's the one in charge. And he has set out the rules of his universe, if you want to think of it that way. And these are the things that we're to do and to not do. And all of us, every single one of us, goes astray from the path that God intends for us to walk. In fact, Scripture says that from the very beginning, from conception, that we're sinful people. And at the earliest of age, when we can choose right and wrong, we choose wrong. Now, I recognize that doesn't sit well with you, but that's the truth. And if you've had a child, it's easy to see. You don't have to teach a kid to disobey. They're hardwired for it. Some more than others, but they're hardwired for it. All of us are. So, the debt we owe is the debt of our very lives. Because God has said, go this way, and we go this way. And we do all kinds of things to try and fix that and straighten that out. But in the end, the debt is so great, we can never repay it. The debt is $12 trillion plus dollars. There's absolutely nothing we can do about it. You can go to church all you want. You can give every penny you ever make to the church. You can serve every day. You can be as moral and as ethical as you want. But no amount of good deeds are ever going to stack up to be enough to tip the scale to where God's going to say, okay. Because there's an internal, intrinsic problem that can only be fixed by the king saying, I forgive you. You're free. Free and clear. Now, sure, we're not as bad as we could be, but the doctrine or the teaching of total depravity says that every part of us is affected by our fallenness, and that all of us go astray. So we're all indebted to God, and there's no way to fix this. But then enters Jesus Christ. Are you awake? Then enters Jesus Christ. Thank you. And what does Jesus do? He gives up the glory of heaven. He comes to earth. He lives a perfect life. And then he takes on our debt. The weight of our sin. He died on that cross taking the punishment that we deserve. And then he rises again by the power of God to show victory, so that the king can look at you and can look at me, who owe the debt, who earned the debt, and say, I forgive you. You're free. At the most rudimentary level, that's what the gospel is. Now, the Bible speaks of this in a really cool term called ransom. And check out this verse from Matthew 20, 27. Read it with me if you would. Even as the Son of Man came, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Here's what ransom means. Ransom means that Jesus' death served as the payment necessary to buy us back from the market of sin. So what was owed can be paid for in full by the death of Jesus Christ. That's what ransom means. So Jesus did that. He did the unthinkable. And as I said, at the very basic bottom level, that's what the gospel means. That those of us who owe a lot to God, that we can never repay it, can be made right with God by the ransom, by the death of Christ. Now, how does that relate to the church? Well, what is the local church? The local church is the collection of people who come together and say, we believe that, that has happened to us, and we want to follow that Jesus together. And we want to share the gospel with others. That's what the church is. So the church should be the place where that gospel is displayed. So guess what? It comes with big responsibility. It's often said that grace is free. You've probably heard that. Grace is free. I don't believe that at all. I don't believe any of that. Grace is not free. It wasn't free to God. It cost Jesus his life. And it's not free to us. Grace comes with significant responsibility. How crazy is it that God would forgive us 12 trillion and we can't forgive each other for 100? That's nuts. That's ludicrous. And yet it happens all the time. It happens all the time that we get hurt by people in the church, and we who went before the king and were forgiven for so great, then we go around choking each other. Not something that ought not happen. So this has everything to do with the church, because the church should be the place where the gospel is displayed. So grace comes with big, significant, enormous responsibility. And that responsibility is that the forgiveness that God has given to us, the grace that God has given to us, the mercy that God has given to us, that we, through relying on Him, would offer it to each other. How many times? An endless number of times. So, what's the church look like? What does the church appear to be where the gospel is centered? What is the church that's got the gospel at the core? It's the church where the skeptic can come and hear about God, the God that some people actually believe can forgive anyone of anything. It's the church where anyone, regardless of what they've done, they'd come, accept Christ, and be warmly embraced. It's the church where that new believer can then grow in that new life and learn how to actually forgive instead of taking revenge. Because that's not natural. It's supernatural. It's the church where people are learning to live out the gospel in every part of their life and every day. It's the church where that gospel is shared with other people, both in the walls and well beyond the walls. It's the church where we understand, friend, that anything is forgivable. Because that kind of church can make an enormous difference. And unfortunately, they're not too common. But I have a dream that Church on Mill can be a church that, first of all, bases who we are on this book. And then we can be a place where the gospel is displayed. Because the world is starving for it. They just don't know it. And if we can be a people that live it out in such a way that people can see, that might not want to hear a word we say, but they can see a tangible expression of it in how we relate to each other and in how we talk about how God relates with us. Man, who knows what could happen? It could be tremendous. So this story, two guys who owe money, one a lot, the other a little, has a lot to do with us today and how we think about God and how we think about each other. I hope you'll think about it deeply and ponder it. And I forgive you. All right, I want to do something a little different. You can stand with me. For our response today, instead of just a prayer, I want us to sing a song that talks deeply about what we've heard. And I want to invite you to enter into it and enjoy it and worship God. And if you need to go to somebody during the song and ask for or extend forgiveness, then that shouldn't be weird that we would do that here, right? Right? Okay? If you're not yet a follower of Jesus and you'd like to experience that complete forgiveness, you can do that by going to God and confessing your sin and asking Him to save you. And if you've not been living in light of that forgiveness that you already have, then you can thank Him for it yet again. But just enter into this song and really worship through it. Let me pray and then we'll sing. God, it amazes me that you would forgive so great a debt when even our very best things without you are like dirty, stingy, disgusting, filthy rags. Even our best days, if we compare them to each other, we might seem okay. We might come out better than our neighbor. But if we compare them to you, they're nothing, absolutely nothing. And yet through Jesus Christ, we are forgiven. The debt is canceled. And God, oh, that we would be a place that then because of that, we'd forgive each other. Help us be that place.